Welcome to Guide to the Cosmos on webtalkradio.net with your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni, physicist, public speaker, and author of Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, and his new second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident? With Robert as our guide to the cosmos, we will explore the frontiers of science and participate in the exciting discoveries of physics, astronomy, and cosmology. Now, providing public access to science, here's your host, Dr. Robert Piccioni.
Thank you for joining us, and welcome back. Today we're going to learn all about binocular telescopes with Jim Burr, who is the president and founder of JMI Telescopes. So, Jim, welcome to our show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Jim, you manufactured these remarkable telescopes that are actually two telescopes in one. Tell us what that is exactly.
Yeah, okay. We have, of course, been building telescopes for some 20-some years, and back in the early, right at the beginning of 2000, I went to work on a binocular telescope. Because when you use both eyes, what you see is just amazing. You're typically with one eye closed. The other eye will soon get eye fatigue, and so you see less and less. And it's even worse, I think, when you're looking at the space. And with both eyes, it's just like being in space. In fact, a good experiment, just put a hand over one eye for a minute and walk around and see what you're missing. Mm. You know, it's more than just a half. It just adds so much. And in fact, I have heard that from an ophthalmologist that about 15% of your brain doesn't fire unless both eyes are working. Some research done by Dr. Tom Mode at St. Mary's University in Texas, his report says that contrast goes up 40%.
I see.
Yeah, so with both eyes, it's just sort of like being in space. The difference is just amazing.
So this is effectively two telescopes, one of which is imaging on each of your eyes?
Yes, that's right. We call it a reverse binocular. It's like a Newtonian telescope, but actually we have one more mirror there, so we bring the light forward. So you actually look down. You can look straight down by looking straight up, or look straight up by looking straight down, because you're looking down into the instrument. It's looking a tube on each side of your shoulders. So light's coming in on either side of your head and going down into these scopes, coming back up to a secondary mirror and then to a tertiary mirror. So you're basically looking down into the instrument.
Okay, great. Now we have some images on our website today that the audience may enjoy looking at while you're listening to the audio track. So go to my website, www.guidetothecosmos.com, and click on the microphone icon and pull up today's show, Binocular Telescopes. And in the first image, you see Jim standing next to three of his enormous binocular telescopes. So these come in a variety of sizes, of course. Can you tell us something about the range that you offer?
Well, the first one that I built was a 6-inch. So you get a 6-inch for each eye. They're F5 focal length. And then we have a 10-inch, which F4.7. And these, by the way, are really easy to move in and out of, you know, your patio or whatever. They have a single handlebar, and you can wheel them out of the garage without doing any assembly, and you're ready to observe. So then we have a 14.5-inch and a 16-inch available. And, in fact, we're building those as fast as we can build them. Well, it takes us a number of weeks to build, to put them together anyway. But and I'm also building a 22-inch, or it's about done, and that one's on a trailer. Planning to go into my house in the mountains of Colorado.
Mm. Now, do you make the optics or do you buy the optics?
Well, we buy the optics, yeah. That's another science, you know, that it's easy to buy optics, and I didn't know, you know, and have time to learn how to make optics. The binocular telescope was considered by some of the biggest names in the industry to be practically impossible to do commercially. A number of people have built them in their garage. But usually, it's quite a job to get these things converged because your stars will be cross-eyed to bring. We're looking at such a small point in the sky. To bring all the stars together is very difficult, and I've seen it over and over again at star parties where people have built their own and takes one person's laying on the ground with a wrench, misadjusting the collimation of the optics to bring the stars together, and the other guy go a little more. No, now go to the other one. So they're actually miscollimating it to bring them in. What I did was to actually move each telescope, and so one has a vertical pivot. So one scope with a motor, I can actually move the scope left and right. The other one has the bearing on the sides, and so it can move up and down. And so with these two motors, you have the X and the Y, and typically we look down the road at a power line pole, and you'll have a pole in each eye, but you run one switch and you bring the poles together, but maybe the crossbars are off. Mm-hmm. You run the other motor. So we're actually electrically, it has six motors on it, so from a hand paddle up at front, you have the ability to bring it in, to bring it right into convergence, and then it takes two motors to do the interocular spacing, because some eyes are different spacing, and mm-hmm. so you need that. Plus, you need a focus for each eye, so we have electric focus for left and right, two motors to do the interocular spacing, and two motors to converge the two optical tubes. And it's really a piece of cake to do that. We just came back from the winter star party, and we had everybody looking through a 10-inch set, and the first night I brought them into convergence, and then we never touched it again for two nights,
So each person has to make some slight adjustment depending on their own optical system. I mean, the position of their eyes and so forth, right?
Yes, with really good eyepieces like the Neglers, they have a range where many people can look without changing this interocular spacing. Focus, of course, each person is maybe a little different focus. So there's push-button switches right there in the hand paddle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it has handlebars on it, actually. And when we started designing this, I figured we started selling these, I was going to have to come up with a go-to and a tracking system and all this kind of stuff. And these handlebars are so natural, nobody's even asking. The only people who are asking for it is a couple of people who haven't tried it. But you're looking down into it, and where your hands would normally be, it's so natural to pan around the sky up and down. It's not like grabbing a Dobson where you turn it on the azimuth and then you have to move it in elevation. It's so natural just to glide it with the handlebars that people who have them aren't even asking for tracking. It's just amazing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How long have you been making these telescopes?
I think it was 2002, I believe, on the binoculars.
Mm-hmm.
We got a Hot Products Award, I think it was in 2003.
Now, your company, JMI Telescopes, has been in business since when?
Well, 25 years, I guess.
25 years.
Yeah.
So you made the more conventional single-tube telescopes before this.
Well, we have over 1,000 part numbers. If you looked in our computer, I think there's probably 2,000 part numbers. In other words, this business started because my telescope wiggled. Every time I tried to focus it, and I came up with motor focus, electric focusing, in 1983, and we started selling that, and I was running a television repair business at the time. In 86, I got out of the business, started designing an NGT-18 scope, and we had focus motors, declination motors, and then some computer makers.
I'm sorry, what's an NGT scope?
Oh, I'm sorry, it's a next-generation telescope. It's an 18-inch.
Mm-hmm.
We still make it. It has, with GoTo on it, it's about $17,000.
So what's
you can stick in the
next?
Back of a two people can stick in the back of a compact car in 2 minutes.
Uh-huh.
It snaps apart, breaks. I mean, it breaks down really easy. It weighs about 200 some pounds.
So what's the next generation aspect of it? Is it the electronic control?
No, it was the mount. Everybody was mindset in German mounts or fork mounts in the industry in the 1990. Nobody thought of a split ring and no commercial, and it still isn't any really commercially made split ring scopes. And I looked at what the big observatories like the Wilson Mount Palomar was doing, and that was a horseshoe mount, a split ring mount. Now the mirror is on the ground rather than being up on a fork and up in the air on tripods, and it sat in a 36-inch circle.
Mm-hmm.
So the drive ring was actually 3 feet across, and so it was low profile, low vibration. It was a beautiful thing, had lots of chrome on it. It had all the features you can't imagine on it. Rotating nose assembly, so you could always have a comfortable viewing position. I mean, I could go on and on with the features this thing had.
Mm-hmm.
Texaro said in his book that a properly built 18-inch scope should weigh 2,000 pounds. So this thing weighs about 200 pounds.
Really?
And it's properly made, I'll guarantee.
Mm-hmm.
It, in fact, appeared in the 1990 Rolex Award for Enterprise.
Oh, that's really amazing.
So, yeah, it's gotten many awards, and it's a beautiful instrument.
And you came up with that in about 1980, you said?
I worked on this for about 8 years. I spent a year just trying to get to perfect the truss rod release, spring release, snap in the truss rod, snap into the tub, and that's why you can break it down so quick, you know.
Uh-huh.
We make carrying cases for all the Meade telescopes, Celestron telescopes. We make focus motors, and we make focusers because so many of the cheap Taiwan focusers will not handle a 10-pound camera. And so we came out with a Crayford design. We were the first commercially to bring in the Crayford focuser back in early 1990, somewhere in there. So we have a focuser line, case lines. We got a computer line that will find objects in the sky, little dedicated computers.
Tell us about that for a second. That's sort of a little miracle that's come into the astronomy world fairly recently. How do you actually operate one of these computers? What do you tell it?
Okay, we have been selling the Max computer. The brains behind that was Tangent Instruments, and they came to us and said, you're the mechanical people. Would you adapt this? So we make that little box fit over 200 different telescopes. So the optical encoders can find, you know, both axis, mount on both axis. It's any 5-year-old could run it. It's a push to. So you push it to the object. So what you do, basically turn it on, it asks you to set deck to zero, or vertical, whichever.
Mm-hmm.
You do that, and then you find two stars in the sky. Hit enter. And then the Max will find 13,000 objects with arrows. Move me 30 degrees this way and 14 up, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you go, as you move the telescope, it counts down to zeros. When you get to zeros, you're on the object. The accuracy will be within a tenth of a degree. And so we make that. Actually, we're close to 300 different models of telescope. You name it, all the Dobbs out there, if it didn't come with the big Schmidts, of course, are coming with go-to computers and so forth. But we've done that before they had that available.
Okay, so once you get the telescope set up and the system calibrated, you type in, for instance, Andromeda Galaxy, and it tells you where the Andromeda Galaxy is?
Yeah, well, it's a little box that has four buttons on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you go up and down. If you want to go to catalog mode, hit enter. Now you've got the Messier catalog, the NGC catalog, the IC catalog, your own
mm-hmm.
catalog,
mm-hmm.
planets, and so forth. So you go to the Messier catalog, M, then you go, you just scroll over to 31, hit enter, guide, boom, and it tells you where it's at. So it's just four simple little buttons on a screen, illuminated screen that scrolls across. It'll tell you M31 is Andromeda Galaxy.
Right.
It's located. It's the magnitude, and it gives you all kinds of information.
Right. That's great.
Scrolls across the screen, and then you hit two buttons, and you're on the guide mode, and boom, it says, okay, to find that, here you do. Just follow the arrows, you know.
And the Andromeda Galaxy is in a different place all the time because the Earth rotates.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the Earth spins on its axis and it goes around the sun, so this little computer has got that all figured out, huh?
Oh, yeah. And it will, if you put it on Andromeda Galaxy and you look at it 1 minute later, you will find that the numbers are changing. It's telling you, okay, the Earth has moved, so Andromeda needs to readjust your telescope to keep it centered in there. So, I mean, it's constantly counting down, with time.
So this takes a lot of the artwork out of being an amateur astronomer.
It really does, you know.
It makes life a lot simpler.
Star hopping is, it's fun, but it's also, you really don't get to see as much when you have to try to star hop, rather than use a computer. You can see 10 times more stuff, probably.
Mm-hmm.
We also make wheels for moving these things in and out of your garage. We make, tremendous. I mean, we got wheels that go on a 20-inch Meade. And it has two, we even have electric drive motors, and it's got 8 10-inch wheels on it. That thing is, like, really heavy. And so we make wheels for, like all the Dobsonians. I had an email from a guy who says, I use my 16-inch light bridge 10 times more since I got your wheels. He just leaves it on the wheels, wheels it out of the garage, levels it with the leveling screws. He says, normally I have to carry out the base, carry out the tub, carry out the nose, put the truss rods on, collimate it, and he says, at 2 in the morning, you're trying to get this thing back into the garage. Now, he says, if it's going to be clear tonight, I email my neighbors, and we wheel it out and look, and we wheel it back in when we're done. I use it 10 times more, so our wheels have been a steady product. I see an order just came in from a school who's getting 5 sets of them here, some school back east.
How much does one of those telescopes weigh?
Well, they go on, I mean, a couple hundred pounds, depending on whether you've got, you know, 8-inch, 10-inch, 14. I mean, that 16-inch scope must weigh 400 pounds.
Yeah.
You know, and the 20-inch probably weighs 1,000 pounds. I don't remember exactly, you know.
And it has to be rigidly positioned so that the thing doesn't wiggle in the breeze.
And you have leveling screws, so you can level and lock. And we have people that put a little pad somewhere, and they go out and mark a spot, or maybe they take a concrete drill and drill a little dimple in their driveway, and they wheel it out and level up the screw, put the screws in the dimple, and now they know they're polar aligned for north, you know.
You are listening to Guide to the Cosmos on WebTalkRadio.net. I am your host, Robert Piccioni, and we are talking about binocular telescopes with Jim Burr. Well, I'm very happy to tell you that our show has a new sponsor, CruiseDirect.com. So when you're planning your cruise, the best place to get the best prices and the best itineraries is CruiseDirect.com. You can choose your cruise by destination or by cruise line or by budget. Go to CruiseDirect.com, your online destination for cruising. We'll be right back after these messages.
Explore Dr. Piccioni's website, GuideToTheCosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts that are available to you, our radio audience. Robert's first book, Everyone's Guide to Atoms, Einstein, and the Universe, makes the exciting discoveries of modern physics, astronomy, and cosmology understandable for everyone. And it was just selected as the best science book of the year by National Best Books. As Robert says, you don't have to be a great musician to appreciate great music, and the same is true for science. If you can change money, you can understand Einstein. Robert's second book, Can Life Be Merely an Accident?, describes how precisely tuned the universe is to support life, and shows how amazingly improbable that is. Go to Robert's website and send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future shows. That's GuideToTheCosmos.com.
We're back talking about binocular telescopes with Jim Burr, the president and founder of JMI Telescopes. What's the biggest telescope you guys have ever made at JMI?
1 meter, 40-inch telescope. It's on a four-wheel trailer. It's a folded. It was F4. It's a folded light, so a Newtonian that has a flat mirror up at the top or in the middle and brings the light back down. So normally a 40-inch telescope, you'd have probably a 14-foot ladder to look into it. Now the eyepiece at the zenith is 8 foot. This scope is up in a school in New York, Oneonta College in New York, and they're bragging they have got the biggest telescope in New York. Like schools want to have the best soccer, the best football team.
I discovered
these schools want to have the biggest telescope, and I just got a letter from him at Memorial Time, and we're going to have first light. He says, you know, he started listing off the different schools. This school's got a 25, and that one's got a 30, and this one's got a 30 and a quarter, but Oneonta has a 40-inch telescope.
Well, the bragging rights of New York State, huh?
Yeah.
That's great.
We did design a couple scopes. We sold two to the NASA for the Mars Science Lab, which it's been changed and delayed now. It's not no longer called the Science Lab, but to get data back from Mars, that's kind of an interesting story.
Well, what's the story on that?
We have time. Well, the plan for the Mars Science Lab was to use a laser, a modulated laser, on the orbiter going around Mars.
Mm-hmm.
Right now they're using RF. Well, you really can't aim RF. I mean, the footprint from Mars is like a couple hundred million miles. In other words, that signal spread out a couple hundred million miles. Laser, the footprint would be like 50 miles when it hits Earth. And the orbiter, we could actually control the laser from Earth. We could actually aim it. And so it's optics, so we need a telescope rather than a satellite dish to get data from Mars. Well, right now they're getting 1 megabyte a second from the Spirit and Opportunity from Mars on RF. Going to laser, it'll go from 1 megabyte to 100 megabytes a second, so they'll get a lot more data.
Okay, so the way this works is that there's a laser beam on the satellite that's
the orbiter,
orbiting
yeah.
Mars, and that laser beam shines back toward Earth.
Yes.
And you said that the spot of the laser beam is 50 miles across when it reaches
Earth. Well, yeah,
Earth.
The footprint, yes, it could spread. In other words, it's going to flare out going through the atmosphere, and mm-hmm. the signal would be somewhere about that, or less. 50
and miles. So it's 50 miles as compared to what you said, 100 million miles
yeah.
for an RF signal.
Yeah.
So obviously it's much more collimated.
Yeah, so you could put the telescopes anywhere in that 50-mile circle, you see.
Right.
You know?
And so they modulate the laser beam somehow to
yeah.
transmit the information.
Yes.
Like modulated radio. And then they receive it with your telescope?
Yes, and they decided that what they needed was 16 30-inch telescopes. They bought the first one in 2002, and they bought another one in 2004 for testing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the project ran out of money, so the laser is not happening. In fact, the whole thing was canceled. It was supposed to launch in 2009. Now it's going to launch in 2010. It went from the Mars Science Lab. The name has changed to Mars Curiosity. But they still think the way in the future, the way to get data from space is to use a laser rather than radio.
Oh, I see.
So they're trying to save the data that they learned.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one other interesting thing, if we got time. The Messenger spacecraft is imaging Mercury now with a laser. This is a small laser. Well, in May of 2005, they turned the Messenger around and aimed it back at Earth, and I got a call from the JPL. Vic over there at JPL says, hey, we've got a free laser in space. We're going to use your telescopes to get data back
mm-hmm.
to test this laser response. And what blew me away was the laser was going to, they were going to fire it at 11 in the morning, 11 o'clock, 11 a.m., and the position of the Messenger spacecraft was 5 degrees away from Cirrus. Well, the sun is not that far away either. I mean, this broad daylight and this weak little laser from a million miles or a couple million in space, you're going to get a signal at 11 o'clock in the morning. And they fired it for, I think it was 5 microseconds it was on, and then it was off for like 200 microseconds, something like that. And apparently they were able to get some data back so they could test it even in the daytime, which kind of...
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing. So the thing is right next to the sun, being right next to Mercury.
Yeah.
And this laser is shooting back at Earth in full daylight.
Yes.
Trying to overpower the light of the sun.
Yes.
But I guess they know the frequency and they modulate it,
yeah.
and so they can...
Well, it was a very weak signal. They weren't really, mm-hmm. this wasn't designed to send
right.
data back. This was designed to image Mercury, which is really close when they get there, you know.
Right.
But
then they data process the signal and they fish out the little,
yeah.
the blip that they sent themselves. Okay, how cool that is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So what are your plans for the future?
Well, we're going to fill out the line, I think, with binocular telescopes. We just came back from the Winter Star Party in Florida, and it just totally blew people away. The very first guy who looked at M40 Orion said, I'm so sorry I looked through this thing. And he came back a couple more times. I heard him say again, I'm so very, very sorry I looked through this thing. The second guy who looked through the binoculars at M42 said, I'm going home and clean out my garage. I'm going to sell every telescope I've got. Another guy came back in the morning.
Yeah.
And said these things are 10 times better than the splitters. We have the bino viewers, which will turn any telescope into a two eyepiece, you know, type binocular. Of course, it divides the light.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people realize how fantastic these things are, I cannot even print some of the comments we heard there. And so I think we need to fill out the line maybe with an 8 and a 12-inch. We have I'd like to build an 18-inch, but that'd be down the road a ways.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd have a 6, a 8, a 10, 12, 14 and 16 to fit now and then, you know, fit everybody pocketbook, and we'd be trying to. I'm going to try to make these a little bit more portable too. So the next time we do some design to make them a little lighter and easier to move and so forth.
Now, do people do any digital photography with a bino telescope?
Well, it really, you could, but it's not going to track. You know, you've got a manual tracking. I did. We did take this over to the UFO conference at Laughlin, Nevada a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, hey, this is the perfect thing for looking for UFOs because you can put a video camera in one side and you can follow it with the other eye.
Ah.
And they put me on the conference in the opening ceremonies there at the speaking schedule at the Flamingo Hotel in Laughlin. And we put one up on stage and told them all about it. And in fact, we demoed it on jets because we could from there we could follow jets for 100 miles following this way. But I included a video camera with each sail so that they could actually video it and they could actually follow it with one eye. In other words, track the UFO with an eye and get a picture of it. So
did you sell some telescopes to the UFO people?
We did. Yeah.
Have they reported any UFOs?
You know, nobody's gotten back with me. But the director actually showed me pictures he had taken of UFOs, you know.
Oh.
At the Laughlin. And what was interesting, he said last year at this Laughlin Hotel, I think that's the Laughlin, I mean at Laughlin, Nevada or whatever, right on the border there. He said last year, here's a picture, and he rolled out a picture. Here's a picture I took right from there. He says, it's as if the UFOs know that we're there.
Well, if they're smart enough to get here, they might be smart enough to know what these guys are doing.
Well, I don't believe in UFOs myself, but
I
think there's some
other
activity
going on
there.
I guess that makes two of us, but everybody's entitled to a certain degree of insanity.
Well, I don't mind selling who I sell scopes to, you know.
I see. Even the UFO people have the same green money, huh?
Yeah, right.
Sure.
And, hey, it would, if they're trying to do that, it would... It would help them do their job, and
right.
That's what the man said when he introduced me. He said, I think this will help us do what we're trying to do.
So how big is your company?
Well, I have about 11 employees.
Well,
bought a building. We're using about 15,000 square foot here.
And you're in Lakewood, Colorado?
In Lakewood, just west of Denver, yeah.
And there's good viewing there, huh?
Well, we got a big parking lot here, and we do put the lights out sometimes from the parking lot, but I'd rather do it at home in the mountains where I live, but... We had a guy came in from Tennessee, and he said, you know, I've seen your 10-inch binoculars at Riverside. I'm interested in the 16-inch binos. He said, they're twice the money. Are they twice as good? And I put the parking lights in our parking lot. We got a big lot here. Put the lights out, took him a 10 and a 16 out there, and I said, just help yourself. I'm going in. He came back about an hour and a half later. He says, the 16s are not twice as good. He said, they're four times better.
Mm.
And he bought the 16s. He was from Tennessee.
Mm. Well, that's really impressive. Okay, is there anything else you'd like to say about your product?
Well, our website is, you can just go to jmitelescopes.com and you'll see that we make all kinds of accessories wherever there's a need. We tend not to compete with other companies. If somebody's doing a good job of doing something, we're not going to jump in and say, well, they're making 20%, we can just survive on 18 or something. We tend not to just do that. We are looking, in other words, years ago, Meade came out, and I don't know how much more time we got, but Meade came out with this LX90. I developed 12 accessories for the LX90. It was the ETX90. And we sold so many accessories for that little thing. So we look at these scopes like the SE, Celestron SE. We made a case for it. We made a piggyback camera mount. You can mount a camera on it. We made counterweights so you could balance it. We made a case for it. We made electric focusing for it. The computer is mounted on the fork, and you're trying to look in the eyepiece, and it's cold outside. Now you got to stick your head around in the fork and run the buttons. And we made a little snap-on holder. I mean, you don't make any money out of it, but it's a little snap-on holder. And so from the eyepiece, you can see and run the computer, a little hand paddle, because they fall out. They really don't stay in that fork very well. They fall out all the time.
Mm.
And so we made a little snap-on thing. You just drop it in. So we just kind of look at all these accessories and what needs to be done. And people call us and say, you know, you need to do this or need to do that. Dealers tell us. So we tend to make stuff nobody else makes.
So you're clever about the human engineering, human factors.
Well, yeah. I think
making the telescope more convenient.
Yeah, I think the Lord's given a gift here to do things like that. And so... And not everything's success, you know. We have some failures too. Some things we think that would fly and don't, you know.
Well, it's such a science, right?
Yep.
And you have some beautiful pictures that your customers have taken using your telescopes that are also on your website.
Yep. So that really put us on the map back in 1990 when we came out with that NGT-18. We had a customer, Dave Young, that bought it and just got into photography, and we plastered his pictures every month in the magazines. And, you know, that really, I mean, we sold, we were selling those, I think, two a week at the beginning. It was a hot product. It was a product whose time has come, you know.
I see. And, how many telescopes altogether by all the manufacturers do you think are purchased every year in the United States?
I wouldn't have any idea.
Well, is it thousands or tens of thousands? Or
Yeah, I would think more than thousands. I would think tens of thousands. I know the president of Celestron, the guy who founded, one of the founders of Celestron, Alan Hale, told me one day, he says, you know, where do all these scopes go? He says, we build scopes, we sell them. He says, I've traveled all over the world. I've never seen a telescope. They're in a lot of closets, you know.
I see.
We just got to get those people out to look through them.
Absolutely.
Know? Yeah. Well,
if you buy a nice telescope, why would why would you not use it?
There's Saturn out there tonight in the east. You know, it's going to be there for pretty much all summer.
Okay, great.
Not going to be in the east all summer. It's going to move a degree every day to the west. But
okay. So again, that's jmitelescopes.com.
Yes.
Okay. Wonderful, Jim. I want to thank you very much for joining us today. That was great to learn about this new telescope technology. Binocular telescopes. Who would have thought? What a great idea.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you for tuning in. And remember, you are never too young or too old to wonder why.
Don't forget to explore Robert's website, guidetothecosmos.com, and check out the spectacular discounts on his books that are available to you, our radio audience. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions for future show topics. That's guidetothecosmos.com. Goodbye.